Coming to you from various places around the world, this is the Global Exhibitor Podcast, the podcast designed to help exhibitors succeed internationally.
Chevrolet and Ford also at various world fairs set up miniature assembly lines and created cars on the spot so you could watch how they're made, See the craftsmanship at work. So once again, you're seeing the company, you're spending time watching a process.
Your host for the Global Exhibitor Podcast is Jeff Hanna, a designer, entrepreneur, business strategist, industry thought leader, and student of world cultures based in the United States. Here's your host, Jeff Hanna.
Well, hello everyone. We're broadcasting live today from Las Vegas at the Great Mandalay Bay Convention Center. And what happens in Vegas is certainly not staying in Vegas right now, as this is going out globally. I'm excited today about the guest, one which I believe will be one of our best interviews so far, but you can be the judge of that. I truly believe that you're in for a real treat, as this was just an absolutely fascinating conversation with Mr. Charles Pappas. Charles is the author of a book called Flying Cars, Zombie Dogs, and Robot Overlords. He's a senior writer for Exhibitor Magazine and a frequent speaker at various conferences, including Exhibitor Live, which is how we first met many years ago. Charles is like the Indiana Jones, Captain Ahab, or Mr. Peabody of the exhibition industry. He's dug up lost photos in Shanghai and located forgotten fair buildings in Mexico City. He has spent years sleuthing out not just the economic impact, but cultural imprint of trade fairs, which is a key point of his book, which we're going to talk about more in just a few minutes. But the impact of trade fairs lasts long beyond the end of the show. But Charles has covered the expo industry for Exhibitor Magazine for many years and is the industry's de facto historian. And yes, it really is Charles here today. We're excited to be able to spend time with him, and we did take quite a bit of time in between his book signings and other events, which I greatly appreciate. He has shared lots of fantastic insights with us, and I believe that this will be one that you may need to listen to more than once to really let it sink in. And we're airing this podcast in two parts. So let's get right into part two of my interview with Charles Pappas on the Global Exhibitor Podcast.
Well, Charles, what are a couple of the things that you would say that you've learned from your travels abroad and interacting with other cultures that you would give as advice to people?
Think locally. How do the people act? What are their taboos? What are their preferences? What is the body language? Do you know, for example, that you should not use Winnie the Pooh in China? That's a big one. Do you know the certain gestures in America that are not rude here, like the thumbs up, can be rude in other places? Now, we've all sort of heard this a little bit, but I cannot emphasize enough that when it comes to especially relations between the sexes in a business environment, is what I mean, you have to be extraordinarily careful to maintain both decorum, body language, and not to make a false step. To make it very simple, I would say you can look at exhibiting, for example, in other cultures in two ways, business and relationship oriented. To which cultures does data and business itself mean more than the relationship? And in which cultures does the relationship mean much more? Because after all, that's going to determine what statements are said, what lies might be told, lies in good faith because they don't want to hurt your feelings. For instance, from my understanding, Brazil tends to emphasize relationships more. You have to connect first before you can really do business. And that means late night dinners. That means not turning down social invitations. On the other hand, you could look at Russia, which, as the writer and lecturer here at Exhibitor Live, Terry Morrison often says, is a zero-sum game to them. What they give you in negotiation, they feel they've lost. It's a zero-sum game. Other cultures don't necessarily view it that way. But if they do, you need to go in prepared for that. You need to go prepared for groups that will not tolerate dissent, that need a group decision to be made before anything can happen. There's so many aspects to that. It's that idea that we are not alone, we are not special, and we need to adapt to others' environments. That's driven home with every time I travel, and especially in business, because there's a bottom line there. You'll either gain something or you won't.
Yeah.
I just had a meeting with two Russian people just earlier today, so it's funny that you mentioned that. But we didn't make any deals, so we just talked. No deals were struck. But they gave me a few gifts, so that was nice. They brought me some chocolate and things like that, which is also one of those cultural things. We often don't think about bringing gifts, but it's funny. I met with some friends from Mexico earlier today. They brought me a small gift, and I don't always think to bring gifts. You know,
No, we don't think it is very common,
of course, in many cultures, even if it's small. A little giveaway kind of thing. It does have its place, and it's just like learning basic greetings in Spanish or Japanese or whatever culture.
Well, as to mention Terry Morrison, as she points out in her books and her lectures, there's the concept in Japan of that kind of, how should I put it, a very polished empathy of anticipating what the other person, especially in business, needs or wants and meeting that. And it takes genuine human concern. We tend, I think, not to really think like that. Yes, we acknowledge it. We acknowledge it's important, but we don't necessarily start with that mindset and have it automatically there when we do business elsewhere, outside the United States.
Well, that leads me to this question I wanted to ask you about, because in a conversation yesterday, you were talking about the Dunning-Kruger effect, I believe it's called. Could you talk about that a little bit more?
Sure.
Because so many companies think they're doing it right. I run into situations where, let's say I'm advising a client that may be an American company going to a show in Germany, and they say statements like, oh, we do that show, we've done it for 3 years in Germany, and there's this connotation being made or suggestion being made that they know everything there is to know about working in Germany because they've done the show 3 years. And I often will say, well, do you really connect with them on the level that you think you're connecting with them on? But talk about that.
Well, Dunning-Kruger is a term that's become more and more popular lately. Several years ago, two social scientists, Dunning and Kruger, devised a scale for measuring what people know, what they think they know, what they don't actually know. And they found there's a direct correlation between when people think they know a subject, they tend not to. In other words, the less they actually know, the more they inflate what they think they know about it. There's a direct kind of inverse proportion there. I don't know anything. That means I have too much confidence in what I know. It's devastating for people and for business, but they're convinced. They're convinced of their knowledge. And it's very hard to dislodge them from the idea that you really don't know Jack. It's a horrendously difficult problem for businesses and for someone, for instance, for an exhibit house. How do you tell a client you don't know something when they're adamant about it? How do you get them to understand that you may not be the master of this particular domain?
It's a challenge, for sure. I'm fascinated by your knowledge of facts and figures, by the way. It's been really interesting.
My boss, Randy Ackerman,
yes,
calls me a freak of nature.
Oh, does
so,
he?
Yes.
He's a good guy, though.
He is.
Consider him a friend. But that's interesting. But I think it's refreshing in our industry, though, because so many times in our industry, it tends to be about the nuts and bolts side of things. And I was talking to a group of students earlier from Fashion Institute of Technology in a session we had with them that, you know, culture is intangible and therefore not so easy to grasp at times. You know, it's a lot easier to talk about lighting and tables and conference rooms, things like that, than to talk about culture. And then it does get to the situation of the Dunning-Kruger effect, where people think they understand and know a lot about culture. And that's one of the reasons we have this podcast, is to try to uncover that more and help people realize there might be other layers of the onion that haven't been peeled yet that people don't understand.
I think it goes back in many ways to the general perception of the industry as a kind of grungy, less than, you know, marketing tool, not quite up there with everything else. And because of that, it doesn't get the respect it deserves, and therefore maybe not some of the resources it deserves in terms of how you would create exhibits if you think of it just as carpeting and lighting and flooring and a banner stand. If you only think of it in those terms, well, no, you're never going to expand past that into something else. And I think that's part of why we don't have that connection to the history we've made and the history we're continuing to make.
Interesting. Have you always been interested in the cultural side of things as well?
That's just the travel bug asserting itself. Mark Twain said that travel is fatal to prejudice. And I think that's true. But prejudice intellectually, emotionally, on many different things. And you learn, especially in seeing World Expos and seeing other countries take up the mantle, if you will, from the U.S., who used to do these, who used to host them, I should say, and now other countries are doing it. So you're seeing World's Fairs, for example, in Asia, in the Middle East, places where other countries are coming to the forefront. So in that sense, the cultural aspect is really interesting to me about how we use these expos, how we show ourselves, how we demonstrate. And that really raises a lot of interesting questions because, again, are we doing enough to keep up? Or are we becoming somewhat second rate at that? You see a huge emphasis often on design in many European stands. You see an emphasis of it in the U.S., but not often as much, possibly because many of the trade fairs go on for much longer. See, you want to see a more engaging visual aspect. Why pour money into something you're going to use for 3 days? Something you're going to use for a month, you might do that. Or you might look at shows like, for instance, Baselworld, the jewelry and watch show, which is known for $30 million exhibits.
Oh, yeah. We've done some there.
And some that look like the Palace at Versailles. They look like the Louvre Museum. And that is where I see the cultural differences often coming up, not only in interpersonal relationships, which are important, of course, but even in design choices and the emphasis on design. Yeah, whereas sometimes definitely. We are a little bit too utilitarian, maybe, and we sort of think you just plunk it down, they'll come, you sell, you go home.
When you're looking at the various pavilions in the countries and how they've approached those projects, do you think they've been as culturally sensitive as they need to be, or are they more taking it as an exercise to project an image of how they want to be viewed as a country? And which countries do you think are doing a better job of that than others?
Germany does the best job of all.
Okay.
They are masters of storytelling. They are masters of leading you through a pavilion divided into many exhibits, but which all come together, which all kind of storybook together. Let's put it that way. Imagine Hansel and Gretel on a path. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going on the path they set out for you to tell a story about water usage, ecology, a better urban environment. And they're able to kind of entice you with both kinetic sculptures, with hands-on materials, hands-on things you have to do, infographics, which are marvelously done by the Germans. They're truly masters of it. Now, there are many others that do some great. The Chinese in 2010 did a masterful job with showing a classic Chinese picture, which measures by about 8 by 11 inches. But they used a proprietary technology to make it almost 400 feet long, about 40 feet high, with all the characters in it moving, as if you were looking into an enchanted wonderland. It was magical, and I mean that in the most literal sense of the word. It felt magical. So it was Chinese pride, Chinese history, Chinese technology, entrancing you without a word needing to be spoken in any language. But you got it. You understood what this was all about. But again, back to the Germans, I would say they emulate them, follow the Germans as far as storytelling abilities go. I find them utterly fascinating. And one time in 2015 in Kazakhstan, 2015 in Milan rather, the Kazakhstan pavilion used sand painting, an ancient Kazakh art, to teach the history of their country, which they presented in a multimedia presentation. But they had a woman who knew how to sand paint do this with these remarkably quick gestures of her hand, create sculptures and paintings, which then told the story of Kazakhstan that was projected on this massive monitor that, but you could also see her working. So you combined a couple things, history there, art, and process, which is something that people often love to watch in an exhibition, but we don't always realize that because it's kinetic. For instance, in 1939, to convince people that swift meats were hygienic, they created an entire meat packing plant, and they let you watch them pack meat on an assembly line. Chevrolet and Ford also at various world fairs set up miniature assembly lines and created cars on the spot so you could watch how they're made, See the craftsmanship at work. So once again, you're seeing the company, you're spending time watching a process
yeah.
of something to nothing.
You made mention of the Saudi royal family, certain scent that they use. And could you talk about that? Because I thought it was really fascinating, so I wanted
well, it's
you to
the
share.
Oud. It's the Oud, which is an extremely smoky, intense fragrance. And you tend to notice it as a cologne and perfume used often in the Middle East. It tends to announce itself before anyone wearing it arrives, you know, announces it ahead
you
of them.
You smell it before you can see the person.
And, of course, in the United States, we tend not to do that as much. We also tend to have many more people who are extremely sensitive to fragrance. So, again, that's something that, one, others have to acclimate to when they come here, and we have to acclimate ourselves to when we go there. But that's one version of a sense that would probably be different, especially in the Middle East, that you're going to encounter this, and it may be jarring at first. It may be difficult to acclimate to in some given sections of it. I've traveled a little bit in the Middle East, and again, you find it very common there. But there's other things, of course, with dress, with comportment, other things there that you just have to be very careful about. But as far as a sensory exhibit goes, you're right. That's something that is very, how should I put it, difficult, because in any large show, you have a variety of people. Some may be international, some not. How do you avoid offending yet enticing people at the same time with your array of sensory attractions?
Yeah.
Whether
yeah.
light, scent itself. I would say scent itself is probably the most touchy. You can get away with a different use of sound, with a different use of light, even tactile things. But smell is something that's very, very particular, can be very culturally bound, and tends to attract the more primitive impulses of the brain, because it goes deep in the hippocampus when people smell things. And it tends to evoke old memories more than almost any other thing, perhaps sound, but that's about it. And it's hard to balance that.
Yeah.
Plus the fact that if you associate a smell others think is bad, but you associate with a good event, you'll like that for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. There's a smell researcher named Rachel Herz, who, when she was very young, was going on a family vacation. They went by a runover skunk, but she associates that smell with leaving on family vacation, and she doesn't find it distasteful.
Oh, my.
So again, too, smell is probably the most difficult one.
Yeah.
And you really need to think that one through if you're going to use it
yeah.
in your booth.
I don't see people using it very frequently, so
I think 80% of people might love it, but what if 20% of people are repelled?
Yeah, that's true.
What do you do then?
Let me bring it to a close. This has been fascinating, and I think I could ask you
delightful.
About pretty much anything, and you would have some pretty good answers.
Oh, I can go on all day about this.
So what are the one or two must-read books in addition to your book,
right, thank
of course?
You. Anything by Robert Rydell. He's a University of Montana professor who writes about world fairs and is extremely knowledgeable. He's written several, so I would say just take his name, Robert Rydell, plug it into Amazon, and you'll get something worth reading. The other, the king of this particular niche, is The Devil and the White City by Eric Larson, about the 1893 World's Fair, which in the background, a serial killer of epic proportions, Henry Holmes, H.H. Holmes, was working. But he contrasts those two, one morbid, one wonderful event, but gives you a sense of what that fair was really like when you have L. Frank Baum getting the inspiration for Oz from it, when you have the first Ferris wheel, when you have Walt Disney's father working on the fair and conveying some of that sense of wonder to him. When you have Tesla and Edison literally competing against each other to see whose system of electricity would be adopted, and they tried the best showmanship they could to win that battle. You had the Pabst Blue Ribbon there. You had the launch of the Aunt Jemima brand there. You had massively oversized props like a Garland stove that was something like 80 feet tall put in there. It was a real sense of wonder. And there used to be ads around America encouraging you to mortgage your home to go see the fair. That book gives a real, real dynamic sense of it. You can curl up with it, and if you start reading it, you won't stop reading it. So I highly recommend that one.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, this has been a great interview with Mr. Charles Pappas of Exhibitor Magazine, and also well-known in the industry and known as the author of Flying Cars, Zombie Dogs, and Robot Overlords. So thank you, Charles, for joining us.
Thank you. This has been delightful.
If you want to reach out and connect with Charles, you can find him on LinkedIn or on Exhibitor Magazine's website or in our show notes here with the podcast. His book is also widely available through Amazon and many other places online. This has been part two of a two-part interview with Charles Pappas. If you haven't yet listened to part one, please be sure to check that out as well, plus the many other great episodes that we have out there on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
We like to remind people that all business is conducted within the context of culture. So each episode provides insights to help marketers understand the cultures they're trying to reach and strategies for building bridges across cultural divides. If you like the Global Exhibitor podcast, please share it with others, subscribe to it, and rate it on iTunes. We greatly appreciate the feedback. Please also check out our website and blog at www.globalexhibitor.com. And finally, if you or someone you know would make an interesting guest on this podcast, please let us know by sending an email to guest@globalexhibitor.com. And until next time, thank you for listening.